All right. The audience is listening. Okay, so today I have a few announcements. I'll grade your electricity tests and I'll give you some feedback. I'll either send it as an email or there'll be a link to a website where you can enter some combination of ID number to get the information. I've also handed out information on the papers, and let me just go over a couple things with that, if I might. If you lose it, it's also linked into the website syllabus right here. So your paper's not due till the last day of class, and it's strategically due before class, so you won't be preoccupied during class. You'll just email it to me. Okay, so just email it as an attachment, and then I'll make comments in it using track changes feature and then send it back to you that way. The other deadline that isn't explicitly on the syllabus but is explicitly in these guidelines is that I'd like to have you give me a short synopsis of what you'd like your paper to be on, and that would be due the Monday, not immediately following spring break, but the following Monday, which is the 31st, I believe, Monday, March 31st. That'll give me an idea of whether or not your paper seems to be something that is too big, too small. Is there a literature on it? If there's anything I can help to, you know, point you to, I can do that. And just also, it's a deadline to get you thinking about the paper, still with plenty of time to start working on it. Okay. Now, the paper length differs for 401A and 501A. So for 401A, you're looking at about 10 to 15 double-spaced pages, and for 501A, you're looking at 15 to 25 double-spaced pages. But otherwise, the guidelines are all the same. It follows the format of an NIH grant proposal. It's actually an R03 award, a small grant. And you could think of this as writing as if I were to, you know, if I had lots of money, you'd be asking me, would I fund your study, right? Would this seem like a good idea? And is this something you've thought about carefully so that you could run the study? The goal of this is, hopefully, it should be fun because you can apply psychophysiology to an area that interests you. For some of you, it might be useful. Many times after a course like this, people will run a study that they've proposed. Last time I had a class about this size, four people ran the studies that they had proposed in the paper. It also is designed, of course, since it's a requirement of the course, to show me that you've really thought carefully about how to run a psychophysiological experiment, how to acquire the psychophysiological data, and what you do with those data. So it will be heavy on the methods. And that's what I like about this format, is it gives me a little bit of an introduction, but then a majority of this, at least half of it or more, is focused on your research study, how you're going to do it, what measures you're going to get, and how you're going to analyze those data. So the format is provided generally here. There's four components to one of these, although for many of you there will just be three components to it, depending if you've done any work in this area already. So the specific aims usually is about a page and a half to two pages double-spaced. And in there, we just ask you to give a very little bit of background that establishes the topic. Tell somebody, you know, why is this an exciting and important area, and why would psychophysiological approaches be useful? And maybe more specifically, why would a particular approach that you're going to take be useful in this? And with that, you give just enough information for the reader to appreciate the hypothesis or hypotheses that you're going to test. And you conclude this section with your hypotheses that you're going to test. Then there's a short section, a few pages of background that would ground this in the appropriate literature. If you're doing something in social psychology, then you might be talking about stereotype threat. You might be talking about mirror exposure. You might be talking about cognitive dissonance. If you're doing something in the memory literature, you might be talking about different memory systems. If you're doing something in the clinical area, you might be talking about a particular disorder and the research on that disorder. And, of course, part of that background would be any psychophysiological work that had been done to date, if it's relevant. Sometimes people propose a psychophysiological study because the literature doesn't have one, and it would be really nice to have one. Okay. And in this section, don't be fooled by section 3 saying preliminary studies. Preliminary studies done by other people and out in the literature go in this background. Preliminary studies are things that have happened in your work or in if you're working in a lab, in your advisor's lab, because sometimes people like to propose studies that build on what they're already doing in a lab. So, as I say, some of you may have nothing in preliminary studies, and that's okay. Just say none. That's fine. But if you're working in a lab already or you've already done some research that leads into this, go ahead and put a little bit in about that. Present the results that you have, even if they're not published. And then, as I said, this is the real meat of it, the research design. So that it'll be really clear how many people are you going to run, what tasks are they going to do, what would the stimulus set look like, what would the exposure durations be, what are the different conditions, how many trials per condition, and those kinds of details. So that really this would be a blueprint, and with very little alteration, you could take that blueprint and start running a study. So why don't you take a look at this over the course of the next week or two. If you have questions, you put them on the 3x5 card. You can just email them to me, and I'll be happy to clarify either individually or if it's something I think that might be a frequently asked question, I'll bring it up here. Okay. Any questions from what you've seen so far? Okay. All right, we'll go to the 3x5 cards in just a moment then. And what the topic of today's lecture will be entirely is just applications of skin conductance. So this, in some ways, deviates from most of the rest of the lectures where we spend some time talking about the foundations of a signal, how to measure it. We've done all that for skin conductance. I'll talk about a few applications, but I'll spend quite a bit of time on deception detection because it's an important topic area. It's one where psychophysiology is thrust into the public eye and one where I think you should come away with some understanding of the current state of the field. So it will be more application than we're typically going to be doing in this class. Okay, but let's start then by looking at the 3x5s from last time. So one question was, skin conductance seems to be a broad construct that correlates with a large number of psychological events. Is it mainly an indicator of general arousal? What can you infer about psychological events with skin conductance? So this is one of the problems that we talked about in the first class period where you have one physiological metric that maps onto many different psychological events. And that's clearly the case. Yes, it is often an indicator of general arousal. I wanted to get a picture in here but couldn't. Just showing, for example, when people look at emotional pictures as opposed to neutral pictures, you're going to see larger skin conductance responses, and it's presumably because they're experiencing some arousal. But I don't think that that would be the only thing you could say about skin conductance. A lot of it's what you can infer will often depend upon how you've set up your paradigm. And so we'll look at that a little bit with some of the examples today. When we talk about deception detection, for example, one of the paradigms, what we can infer is that somebody has a distinctive orienting response to one of the alternatives, okay, a kind of recognition response. I guess the one thing we can say without too much controversy is that when there's skin conductance responding, there's some degree of sympathetic nervous system activation. That would be unambiguous, but that doesn't take us yet then to the psychological significance of that. And, you know, in this respect, a skin conductance response is not any different than, say, a bulb response in a region of cortex in an fMRI study, because you can see that that region of cortex is, you know, goes off in many different studies and many different paradigms. And there's no unique way of interpreting what it does without knowing what was the experimental paradigm that you used to elicit that response. Okay. It was mentioned that prepping the skin for skin conductance, that the subject should wash hands with soap and water. Shouldn't distilled water be used? Would other things in normal sink water interfere with correct conductance? Well, maybe some people sink water, but probably not stuff here in Tucson. What we're worried about in preparing the hands is inadvertently abrading some of the horny layer of the skin, because then that dead layer of skin cells is removed and we won't have any ability to measure change in conductance. We're also worried about some kind of substance that changes the conductance of the layers of skin and would also change over time. Okay. So we don't want conductive creams on there, which is why we would wash them in the first place. We don't want oils and dirt, and that's why we'd wash them in the first place. But there probably aren't things in most people's sink water anyway that you'd have to worry about. The water dries quickly, and it doesn't leave any residual effects on the skin. Okay. Is it okay to use different placements of electrodes on different subjects? For instance, if I place them on the medial phalanges and one of the subjects has a cut on his fingers, presumably at one of the medial phalange sites, can only this subject have electrodes on the thenar and hypothenar eminence and still be able to compare this data, subject's data to the others? So it's a good question. I mean, people get their hands nicked up, they get cactus in them, they get scrapes, they have, you know, things going on. So what should we do with that? Well, If you're a purist and a stickler, you just don't use that subject. Now, of course, this subject might be somebody you spent 20 hours assessing and they've got some rare disorder or some condition you want to do a study on. So maybe then you'd want to use the data. But it's not without some problems. So here was a study specifically looking at the effect of recording site on the skin conductance response level and the skin conductance response amplitude. And you can see here in the red box the findings, but skin conductance amplitudes were 3.5 times larger at distal than medial phalange sites, and skin conductance levels were over 2 times larger at the distal sites. And then there was also a site by stimulus interaction, meaning the responsivity for that the distal sites were more responsive to habituation across trials. So on the basis of those findings, there's a lot more action at the distal phalange than there is at the medial phalange. Now, they didn't check the thenar or hypothenar eminences, but clearly this much difference in these kinds of recording sites would also imply that it may not be strictly comparable moving to another site. Now, sometimes there are ways around that. We talked briefly about range correction, and there's a range correction article, so that might mitigate the effects to some extent, but I'd still be worried that you might be creating an outlier by changing sites. And if you were recording from the medial for most people and moved to the distal, you'd create a responsive outlier. And if you did the other, you'd create a non-responsive outlier. Okay. And in this example, if there were merely just a cut, you might be able to, you know, place the electrode in such a way that you don't get the cut in too much of the area. And if it's just a small cut, well, it's not going to really affect recording. If it's a big, you know, scab, then you probably have some problems. But I think in that case, I would be more inclined to shift fingers than to shift phalanges. Okay, and that's the kind of thing that always ends up in a footnote in your article, right? Okay, do some people have a greater number of sweat glands, that's my typo, per given amount of surface area, and how would this affect skin conductance results between subjects? Excellent question, and it's also one that the group at USC investigated. So the last study was the USC group, this study is the USC group, and this was a methodological study where these poor people had to count sweat glands and relate them to electrodermal activity. In fact, I know two of the authors, and they were just kvetching these first two authors about having to do this, but it's an important thing to do. And here's what they find. Actually, the total number of glands that you have in an area doesn't relate to skin conductance responses. So these are Pearson correlations that you see here on the y-axis, and it's the correlation between total sweat glands here in the dim gray, which essentially is nothing, and open glands here. And so what they did is they had a procedure where they put some kind of film right on the finger, just adjacent to where the electrode was. They pull it off, and it is such that it leaves a different mark if the sweat gland is open versus closed. And then they put it under a microscope, and they simply count it. Okay? And they had two people count it, and inter-rater reliability being rather high, and they come up with all this data. So you can see that the total sweat gland isn't really that important. It really is the number of open sweat glands. Now, I guess all else being equal, people who have more sweat glands have a chance to have more of them open, but at least within the normal range you'd see here in the laboratory, it's the number that are open that really matters. Okay. Final 3x5 question for today. The recording placement for measuring skin conductance seems to give away what the experimenter wants to measure. Would this matter? Well, I think it gives it away to us because we've been talking about this, but I'm not so sure it gives it away to the subject if you really want to be devious. And if you don't want them to know you're measuring sweaty palms, I'm sure you can come up with some other stories. You know, we're measuring finger dexterity. We're measuring muscle activity. You know, those would be cover stories if your IRB would let you get away with them. But even if you're measuring skin conductance, and you tell them you're measuring skin conductance, which I don't think is usually a problem, we're interested in differential responses across stimuli. So you could imagine making somebody aware of their skin conductance responding. They might think about it. They might get a little nervous about, am I sweating a lot? Or they might get more aroused. So their level might go up for a while, but I don't think it would have any differential effect on, say, emotional stimuli versus non-emotional stimuli, recognized objects versus novel objects, and so on. So, in general, it wouldn't matter. And I have to say, just a little bit pessimistically, a lot of the things that we think are really important, our subject pool participants don't usually catch on to. Right? You debrief them afterwards, you think it's going to be really obvious, and there are many people for whom they don't seem to get it, what you're doing. So that could be good, that could be bad, but it's a fact of the subject pool as we know it. Okay. All right. So let's move on and then talk about some skin conductance applications, two of which you've seen already, and so I've just placed links to what we've seen already. Okay. So there's a huge tradition in the orienting response. The orienting response is what we have when there's a novel object in the environment. And by novel, I mean it's different than the things that are in its immediate proximity. Right? So if a puppy walks in this room, will have an orienting response. But if you're out at the puppy park and a puppy walks across the puppy park, there's no orienting response. It's not novel there. So it's within its context. So we can set up paradigms where something is novel in a context based upon some particular feature. And this was what was done creatively by Russ Bauer in the study of prosopagnosia. So this I highlighted in the first letter, the first lecture. I thought it was a particularly creative study where Russ Bauer took a look at the disorder of prosopagnosia. Remember, that's the condition where patients couldn't overtly recognize faces and they didn't know the identity of the face that they were looking at. Okay? They didn't have a general problem with identity. By voice, they would certainly be able to identify somebody. And remember, the patient couldn't name any famous faces, politicians and actors, and couldn't name any of his family members just when presented with the face. The controls, on the other hand, didn't have prosopagnosia. They could name famous people, but they couldn't name the patient's family members because they didn't know the patient. And so what happened in this study was the face came up on the screen, and then underneath came the name, or I think auditorily came the name. Okay. So there would be a name, it comes up, and then there'd be a delay of, say, 20 seconds or so, so the skin conductance can come back down, and then the next name, and the next name. Only one of the names then matching the face. Okay. So this is like the guilty knowledge test that those of you who are taking the lab are doing, and so we're trying to see, is the person guilty of recognizing the right name? And electrodermally, the patient produced the largest skin conductance response to the correct alternative, that is the name that matched the face, for 60% of famous faces, and the controls got 80% there, and for 62.5% of the family members, and the controls only 37.5% of the time, because for the controls, the name shouldn't match in any way to them. Okay? So it suggested that there was an orienting response. There was still something distinct, still something significant about the matching name in that context to the prosopagnosic patient, which suggests it isn't just a total lack of information, but a lack of awareness or a dissociation between these different measures and a dissociation between access to the information that is there but would help them identify the face. Okay? So they talk about it as a functional defect, not at the perceptual level per se, but at a stage of processing where adequate perceptual information is utilized to make a complex decision about the identity of the face.
Did they ever try to separate the auditory
from
the visual?
Bauer did not. I wouldn't expect that it would make a difference, but that would be interesting if it did, certainly. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's a redux, and here's one more. So I think it's a very nice use of skin conductance as a dependent measure. Skin conductance is often the preferred measure of choice when people study fear conditioning. Fear conditioning is a nice paradigm because you can control what it is that people fear. People come into your lab fearing all kinds of idiosyncratic things, but you can make them fear things just by a simple pairing of electric shock, for example, or a loud noise blast, or a loud scream, along with a particular stimulus. And so in the fear conditioning paradigm, there's a repeated pairing of the stimulus you want them to be afraid of, followed by this aversive stimulus. Let's say it's electric shock in this case. So snake, shock, snake, shock, snake, shock. And it gets very predictable, so that eventually people transfer their unconditioned response to the aversive stimulus, like the shock, and it becomes a conditioned response, so that when they see the snake, they also have some kind of anxiety, and importantly, they have a skin conductance response, larger than they would have initially. In these studies, there's also a CS minus. That's another stimulus that should otherwise be comparable that isn't paired with the shock in this case. So you might have spider, nothing, spider, nothing, spider, nothing. Okay. And so in that case, you'd expect then the person would have large skin conductance responses to snakes and not to spiders. And so here's the results of the Ullman and Soares study that I showed you the first lecture. So they had fearful and non-fearful subjects. These are people who a priori said they feared a particular object that they were conditioning to, and it doesn't really matter. The fearfulness of this, or no, these are just generally fearful people, excuse me. And the general fearfulness of these people didn't really matter. What mattered was what was conditioned. So you can see that when people are conditioned to a fear-relevant stimulus, and then it's later presented masked, and that was what was so innovative about this study, it was presented so that they could not explicitly identify it, that even then, the skin conductance responses are still larger to the fearful CS pluses, snakes and spiders in this case. Okay? Importantly, it wasn't just snakes and spiders per se, but only when they were paired with shock. So here we have also snakes and spiders. You know, it's counterbalanced across people, but it's CS minus, so it wasn't paired with shock. So just the mere presentation of a potentially fear-relevant object at masking presentations doesn't elicit a very large skin conductance response. It's only when it had previously been fear-conditioned and the person had developed a fear of that object. And interesting, fear-irrelevant objects, even though you can get conditioning, and when you present them at above threshold levels, people show enhanced skin conductance responses, at these sub-threshold levels, they do not. So the skin conductance becomes a very nice measure, because in a case like this, you can't depend upon the person's self-report, you can't depend upon some rating dial of anxiety, but skin conductance provides a good level, you know, a good index of the degree of arousal in this case.
So is there any idea about what is it that's actually picking up the signals that they can't see it?
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, when we talked about the visual pathway, we talked about the one that went to the occipital cortex, which is the primary visual cortex, and that's what leads, we believe, to the, you know, conscious experience of a visual representation, because if people have damage there, they don't report seeing anything. But there are lots of other pathways, so that information first synapses in the thalamus, and from there, in addition, going to the primary visual cortex, it goes elsewhere. Also, even before it gets to the thalamus, there's pathways to the geniculate, the superior colliculus as well. Some of these pathways feed to the amygdala, and so they're considered a fast pathway. In other words, they don't require as much time as it does to have a conscious perception of it. So that information can be fed down to subcortical structures like the amygdala. Now, that would suggest, and you know, from what I've told you so far, that anything then that was fear conditioned should potentially have this effect. But the thought is that these kinds of stimuli that are fear relevant, there's some evolutionary advantage to being able to, you know, associate fear to them. We're evolutionarily prepared, and so it's only those that, if you will, benefit from this kind of masked exposure, where you can see the enhanced skin conductance response.
So it was still a visual experience.
Yes.
Masked.
Right. What they did is they show the picture, and I'd have to look exactly what it is, but it's 30 milliseconds or even less. And then immediately a mask is put over it, and that's just a chopped up picture, okay, an unrecognizable picture. And so people can't report what it is that they've seen. Okay. Right. And even if they're asked to guess, you know, guess, was it a spider or a snake, they can't guess. So it's really below the level of subjective awareness. Okay. So maybe a couple of other examples of applications before we turn to deception detection. One of these was one of the papers that I put on the reading list, and this was a study looking at individual differences in neuroticism. So neuroticism is an individual difference that can be assessed by self-report, and it's seen as a trait-like tendency. It's fairly stable across people to be highly reactive to stress and to aversive stimuli. So people with neuroticism are going to be a bit by trait, you know, they're going to have a consistent pattern of being more labile in their emotional responses, especially under stress and when confronted with negative stimuli. So the question that was posed by these authors was whether skin conductance would reflect greater physiological reactivity to negative stimuli and potentially poorer physiological recovery. So we'd expect they'd be more physiologically reactive just because they're more psychologically reactive, but would they also have a poorer recovery? So it would seem to affect them longer. And this is what Kat Norris and Jeff Larson and John Cacioppo found. So we have, they actually did a continuous regression in the analyses, but for the purposes of displaying, they split these people at one and standard deviation above and below the median and plotted the functions for that. So looking at the high neuroticism group, what you see is when they see unpleasant pictures, they have the largest response, pleasant pictures next, and neutral pictures the lowest. What you expect in kind of unselected samples is that both pleasant and unpleasant are nearly the same, unpleasant maybe just a little bigger, and clearly different than neutral. So it's really, it seems to be the unpleasant that's pulling away in this group. They're more reactive to the unpleasant than you'd see in unselected samples. Now, the lower neuroticism group is interesting in its own right. Doesn't look quite like the unselected samples, where they actually seem to have a diminished response there to the unpleasant stimuli. So the first thing to notice here in these findings is the magnitude of the response, and you can see it's just much larger here for those high neuroticism subjects than the low neuroticism subjects. But the other feature is how long it takes to recover from these, and you see there's a delayed recovery specifically for these negative, unpleasant stimuli.
So the low neuroticism group, do you know if that's a significant difference between the unpleasant and then the neutral unpleasant, or are they actually less to unpleasant?
Right. I can't remember. I don't know if anybody else remembers from seeing this. Is this a significant difference you're saying?
Right? Yeah.
I don't remember that. Mm-hmm. You remember? No.
How did they quantify the
sort of proposed
baseline
in
the
higher neurons? You mean this baseline here?
For the unpleasant.
Yes.
So you said that you would expect to be closer to the pleasant, but not as large. How are they quantifying that difference? Or are they?
I mean, this difference here?
Between that and what you do.
Oh, they weren't. I was just saying that descriptively. All they're comparing is these subjects, and they're treating it as a continuum, and they've just plotted here one standard deviation above and below the mean. But I was just drawing the distinction between what you usually see in this study is that these almost look identical, and it's clearly not the case here. But they didn't do the unselected kind of plot the median group here. The same time. No, so these are, they're interspersed trials. You have several different, pictures in each category, and they come up in a randomized fashion. So you'll see a picture, I think it's on for 6 seconds, and then it goes off. And then the next one goes up. So it's a standard viewing of the International Affect Picture Series approach. I should have put some pictures in there for people to see if you're not familiar with it. But there are things like snakes and spiders and gory mutilation scenes and pleasant things are skiers and babies and puppies and things like that. So. And neutral is buses and filing cabinets and stuff like that. So they're not all presented at the same time, but then you just line up the skin conductance responses with respect to stimulus onset, and there's a little bit of a delay before you start to see any response, and then you can see the responding there.
So the high neuroticism folks take much longer to reach a peak of reaction than the low neuroticism folks.
They do have a longer latency to their peak, but they also have a higher peak as well. So that could be why. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, they also take longer to recover. So skin conductance then serves as a good measure of emotional reactivity and emotional recovery in this kind of paradigm. The other study to share with you is a classic study about anticipatory anxiety or fear in the psychopath. So psychopaths, as defined by Cleckley or in the current version of the DSM, are people who are cunning and manipulative, take advantage of other people, will often engage in dishonest and even illegal activities, or at least manipulative activities, for their own personal gain, and sometimes doing things that, you know, most people would just quite frankly be afraid to do, right? You don't want to con somebody because you get beat up. You don't want to take something that belongs to you because you could get caught. So one of the theories going around about psychopathy is these people have a deficient anticipatory anxiety. They don't fear the potential, you know, bad outcomes for the things that they do. So Bob Hare developed a countdown task where subjects were hooked up to skin conductance recording equipment, hooked up to a shock electrode, and they knew they were going to get a shock. They even felt it in advance as part of the, you know, pretest. And they say, okay, you're going to get one of these shocks, and they let them feel it. And it was a painful but not dangerous electric shock. And then they just saw numbers appear from 1 to 8, knowing that at 8 they were going to get their punishment, their shock. Okay? So imagine yourself in this task. You felt a painful electric shock. You know another one is coming, and the numbers start going up. That wasn't that way on my screen. Okay, so it was dark on my screen. Here we have the skin conductance response, and here we have the seconds, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And if you're a control, you know, you might imagine as soon as the numbers start, you're going to start showing an increasing skin conductance level, going up and up and up and up until 8, at which point, you know, the shock comes, you have a skin conductance response, and it's all over. Okay? And then the next trial will start in a little while. But the real question is then what happens with the psychopaths? And they stay kind of electrodermally cool for a long period of time and have only a short anticipatory response. So they don't get aroused early and in advance in anticipation of an aversive stimulus. Okay. All right. So the final thing I'll spend today talking about is deception detection. And I'm going to talk some about the electrodermal measures, but more generally about the paradigms that are used to try to assess deception. So we'll talk about the problematic polygraph and then some alternatives. So, you know, we wouldn't need some kind of fancy psychophysiological procedure to try to detect lying if it was obvious. So you see here, if everybody had liar written across their face, like this one, we wouldn't need polygraph tests. But we can't easily detect lying. And so for, you know, the whole history of humankind, people have tried in one way or another to detect when people are lying and get them to fess up and tell the truth. And, you know, the history of torture and other awful things is, you know, a testament to that. And some of the technology, even psychophysiological technology, goes back even centuries. So one of the earliest kind of lie detection tests comes from the ancient Egyptians. And they had a test where the accused would have to take a mouthful of rice and then have to chew it a little bit around the mouth and then spit it out. Okay? And if it all came out nice and clean in a blob, they were innocent. But if it stuck to their mouth, then they were determined to be lying. So this is a very crude measure, of course, of autonomic arousal, with sympathetic arousal. You don't need to be salivating when you're, you know, sympathetically aroused. And the rice stuck, and I don't know how many, you know, consequential decisions they made on this task, but it's an early example of a psychophysiological approach to deception of detection. So you'd like to think that some two centuries later we've done a much, you know, better job, but The short answer is we actually haven't for most of the use of lie detection techniques. So to begin with, I like to quote experts on a topic like this, Richard Nixon being an expert. And the one thing he said that I think is probably pretty apt about the lie detectors is, I don't know anything about lie detectors other than they scare the hell out of people. And that's really one of the most useful qualities of a lie detector, is that it does scare the hell out of people. It makes people afraid that they're going to be caught, and often makes them confess. It's a very useful tool, even in the absence of any validity or being a useful test. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about, you know, why would we want to use lie detectors? Well, there's all kinds of applications. So I thought about this, and a couple of years ago I decided to devise an armchair taxonomy of lies. Okay, this is not exhaustive, it's not validated, but this is my armchair taxonomy of lies. People lie, right? There's all kinds of motivations to do so. So I think there's a class of lies that we shouldn't be interested in detecting. And these are kind of harmless lies. They're part of normal social graces. These are things like, you know, when somebody says, "Do you like the casserole?" You say, "Yes." You know, "How's my outfit?" "It's great." "Do I look fat in this?" "No." So these are just kind of the normal things that people say to kind of lubricate the social landscape. And we probably wouldn't want to have some kind of little red dot on our forehead going off every time we were lying, or the whole social infrastructure would collapse. Okay. But then there's all those other lies. Okay? And it's those other lies, I think, that people get quite concerned about, because these are things that can have some very serious consequences. So oftentimes people get accused of things. Oftentimes people will deny accusations. And, you know, either class of those things could be lies. So imagine if there were some kind of a divorce and child custody issue going on. Then one parent could accuse the other person of having bad parental habits, about being unfaithful, maybe about initiating some physical, sexual, or emotional abuse. They might accuse the person also of some inaccuracies about their income and their assets, all trying to, you know, get more money and get more child time, for example. And of course, if you were, you know, accused of that and you actually did it, you might deny those things. Because if you're accused of those and you didn't do it, you might deny those things. So you could deny all these accusations as well. And, you know, if you don't know who's telling the truth, then you might like to have some procedure that would help you, of course, to do that. So that's, you can see, just one of the many kinds of instances in which something like a lie detector would come into being. Now, I mentioned already that detecting lying is not an easy business. And this was illustrated very nicely by a study printed in the American Psychologist by Paul Ekman and Maureen O'Sullivan. And I think the title was To Catch a Thief. At least that was the main title. There was a subtitle. And in this study, they showed different groups of people videotapes, some of which showed a person who was telling the truth, and some of which showed a person who was lying. And people just had to say for every tape, truth telling or lying. So chance accuracy would be 50% in this task. And they had different groups of people. They had kind of the, you know, intro psych college student subject pool. They had a special interest class that Paul Ekman was teaching, a little, you know, community class on lie detection. They had a group of professionals that you might think should know something about lie detection: psychiatrists, judges, robbery investigators, federal polygraphers. None of these people differed significantly from chance levels of accuracy. Okay? The only group that did, which might make us feel a little safe, is the Secret Service group. But even so, they're still only catching 64%, which, if that's what our, you know, security is based on, it's not terribly good. Now, Ekman and O'Sullivan speculate that it may be that, you know, Secret Service agents, by nature of their training and their line of work, they're trained not to pay attention to what people say, but the way in which they say it. They look for nonverbal cues, emotional expressions, tone of voice, body posture, all kinds of other things that might indicate they were lying. But the main point I'd like to make here is just that, you know, it's difficult to detect lying, and that's why people use various approaches in the service of detecting lying. Now, the polygraph is a test that's been around for over 50 years. It's, I think, embedded itself into the American psyche, and that's part of the reason that it works so well. So this is not an exhaustive sociological study here, but a couple of observations that I have. So this one comes from sitting in West Lafayette, Indiana, during my brother's wedding. And at the next table, I hear, "My coworker's husband's being sent to polygraph school in Atlanta for 3 weeks so he can give the polygraph test." And the companion at the table says, cool. It's like the test that can read your mind, right? And I'd like to think that that was unique to, you know, the early 90s and West Lafayette, Indiana. But I know that it's not. Many people have this belief that a lie detector will detect them if they're guilty. And more importantly, you know, when they're innocent, I want a lie detector, right? That this is the test that's going to, this is going to adjudicate with 100% accuracy. Okay. Now, it's not only the lay public, but there are, of course, writers in the field that, you know, kind of perpetuate this belief. So this was Michael Lynch in The Polygraph, which is a journal of the American Polygraph Association. That's the other APA. And he says, what we, the American people, are witnessing is the beginning of the end of mankind's search for an honest witness. For the first time in the history of civilization, mankind has the opportunity to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the veracity of his testimony through a generally accepted and scientific valid examination of his own psyche. God gave us the polygraph. Okay. All right. And there are even a couple of media portrayals, you know, that benefit from this. So this was a political ad that was going on during the 2006 elections. Does anything? Yeah. And it was designed to give us the impression that our president wasn't telling the truth.
Ladies and gentlemen, President George W. Bush. Saddam Hussein had an advanced nuclear weapons development program. Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. Saddam Hussein aids and protects terrorists, including members of Al-Qaeda.
So, very effective ad, if it's a point that you'd like to make or believe in, but, you know, it's not based on anything scientific. In fact, they weren't even using skin conductance. It looked like they were using EMG on the polygraph tracings there. Okay. But you wish we could have that. It's also the source of, you know, great jokes in entertainment. So, if you happen to be a Simpsons fan, you might be familiar with this.
No.
It's fantastic to think about such an accurate device, right? Okay. So, you know, I just make this point. I'm sure there are other examples. If you have them, send them to me. But the idea is that this is really, you know, something that the populace believes. There is a lie detector, and it can detect lies. All right. So what I'd like to cover here is just a quick history and overview of the conventional polygraph and the limitations of that. I'll talk about some alternatives in assessing recognition, and then if there's time, I'll talk a little bit about event-related potential procedures, but we've, you know, that doesn't, we'll see how time goes with that. Okay. So the polygraph was invented by the Harvard-trained lawyer and PhD William Moulton Marston in 1915. I don't think he had any idea, really, what an impact he would have. And he's shown here, there's this rotating drum, and here's an obviously terrified suspect. She's got a respiration belt and a blood pressure cuff here. And he claimed that changes in blood pressure would be related to lying. So there'd be some sympathetic arousal and when people are lying. And so instead of a piece of paper that goes by, this drum just goes around and the little tracing is made on the drum. Okay. So this wasn't actually his main claim to fame. The main claim to fame of William Moulton Marston was as the author of Wonder Woman. So many people know him better for that. Many of his academic colleagues really thought it was quite a waste of his time to do this, but he really saw this as a great movement to kind of inspire young women, turn them on to science, get them, you know, a role model that they could believe in. So I'll let you weigh in which one of these is the better science, better contribution. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what people call the polygraph test. So there's a machine, the polygraph, which is a generic term for anything that records physiological signals. And then there's a test, the polygraph test, which is this very specific use of polygraph machinery in the service of lie detection. Okay. So the fundamental assumption in these lie detection applications, the polygraph test, is that somehow there's a physiological difference when people are telling the truth versus when they're lying. Or in some cases, there might even be the assumption that there is a lie response, a unique and specific lie response. In other words, going back to the first lecture, a one-to-one mapping. When lying is a psychological construct, there's a unique physiological response. As we'll see several times, that's not the case. Now, polygraph tests are used in a wide variety of circumstances, with some limitations being placed on them over the years. They're often used in specific incident investigations where there's something that has happened and people want to find out, you know, essentially, did you do it or were you involved? So this can involve criminal investigations, obviously investigating people who are accused, but also people who might be a witness or a complainant. They can be used in insurance claims investigations and looking at whether or not prison inmates had violated various rules, substantiating claims made in civil suits, and prior to standard DNA testing, they were even used in paternity identification. Okay. Not anymore there. They've also been used in screening situations, although clearly less now since the passage of an Employee Polygraph Protection Screening Act. They can be used in pre-employment screening to try to find people who might be devious types of individuals that you wouldn't want to have in your company. They have been used in screening current employees, trying to find people who might be dishonest or taking from the company, trying to get rid of them. They've been used in child custody cases, trying to assess suitability or whether or not somebody might have, you know, misbehaved in some way relevant to child custody. And they're used even currently with convicted sex offenders, where some convicted sex offenders will have to submit to routine and ongoing polygraph screening to see if they have committed or are thinking of committing any illegal sex acts. Now, the Employee Polygraph Protection Act of 1988 limited the use of these for current employees and screening purposes. So it prohibits screening tests for employment in the private sector, which takes care of a lot. But this act specifically exempted government workers of all varieties. And so federal, state, local, and government employees, federal contractors, and police can still use it for screening, and many still routinely do. It also still allows tests for those reasonably suspected of involvement in a workplace incident. So if the money in the safe turns up missing and you're a suspect, you still could have to take a polygraph test. I don't know if you've worked at companies where you've had to sign this when you took your employment screening, but I know when I worked at the all-night gas station, this was a condition of employment for that really delightful job, was that I have to submit to a polygraph test if, you know, there were money missing. And friendly tests, that is, those tests that wouldn't really have any outcome, but let's just kind of investigate, see what's happening, those are also still allowed for defendants and currently employed individuals. So it's interesting, you know, that the federal government passes this law to protect people and then exempts all of its own employees and contractors to the federal government. Okay. And although there's been some, you know, limits on polygraph testing, there's also been some expansion. So the National Defense Authorization Act of 2000 requires scientists at nuclear weapons laboratories to submit to polygraph tests to maintain their security clearance. This was after all those secrets and laptops and things were disappearing from nuclear facilities back around the turn of the century. Okay. Now, in terms of the instrumentation and the measures used, there's a multi-channel flight recorder in a suitcase, a little flight case that I'll show you in a minute. And there's usually just a few channels recorded. There's respiration with a strain gauge around the chest, cardiovascular activity in terms of heart rate and blood pressure, and skin resistance, the inverse of skin conductance. Okay. And, of course, these measures provide some rough indication of changes in autonomic activity, but they don't index a lie response, per se. Right? They're not detecting lying. They're detecting autonomic changes, autonomic arousal. So here's what they look like. Here's a flight case, a rather new model, but the technology is essentially unchanged since the 50s. In here, you've got some chart paper that rolls by. You've got pens here that make a nice scratchy noise as they sit behind the subject, just like on that ad that I showed you. A few knobs and buttons to intimidate the uninitiated, and then, of course, blood pressure cuff and some electrodes and wires and leads. The technology, as I said, essentially has been unchanged since the 50s. You can see they did come out with the Fact Finder 2. I guess the Fact Finder 1 didn't find enough facts. And it was only a brief departure from this basic technology when Mattel came out with the official lie detector here in 67 as part of the official lie detector game, the scientific crime game. Again, I put this up just to highlight how embedded this is into the American psyche, right? That lie detection is a scientific enterprise. Okay? And, you know, it's great fodder for movies as well here in Meet the Parents, right? So, and there it is, the Fact Finder 1 right there. Okay. So, this is the classic lying reaction that comes from the Lafayette Instruments manual. So, what we would expect to see if somebody were lying, and I should say what we'd expect to see if somebody were getting aroused, would be three things. In these respiration tracings, these are the pneumatic stretch band around the chest, you see that respiration is more shallow. Okay. Here's the skin resistance tracing or skin conductance tracing. We plotted it up, so there's a big skin conductance response. And in terms of the cardio tracing, this just indicates some peripheral vasoconstriction and perhaps some increase in heart rate. So you see there's some vasoconstriction that you're seeing here. All of it follow fairly shortly after the subject makes a lie to a relevant question. But there's no specific lie response. I mean, this is what you'd like to see, right? That there's subject lies. Of course, if we saw that, then the polygrapher would also potentially be having the same response. And the Office of Technology, a commissioned report, said there's no physiological response that is unique to deception. And I think, you know, that should seem pretty obvious, but unfortunately it's not in the way that these are used. So if you were trying to develop some way to detect that people were lying or trying to deceive you, there are lots of different technologies that can be used. Skin conductance is but one of them. You can use brain electrical activity, you can use fMRI, but no matter what the measure, there are really only going to be three broad approaches to doing this. The first class of approaches are like the standard polygraph that depend upon people being emotionally aroused when they're lying, because they're going to be afraid of being caught, or they're going to be worried in some way of the bad consequences that will occur. So some of this can be detected using the standard polygraph. Other methods, looking at facial expression, for example, Paul Ekman has done work where he sees that when people aren't telling the truth, there's emotional leakage in the facial muscles. And I'll show you some of that when we get to facial EMG in a few weeks. But if you look very carefully when people are lying, especially if you have a video camera and you slow it way down, you can see subtle changes in the facial expression consistent with when people are lying. Voice stress analysis is another example of that. It's notoriously inaccurate because people can be stressed for all kinds of reasons. Changes in facial blood flow, which also cause changes in temperature, facial thermography, even looking at a person's demeanor. These are all examples of this general approach, okay, using a variety of different measures, but looking for signs of emotion or arousal when people are lying. A different approach is the guilty knowledge test. So in lab, you've been introduced to that. But the idea here is that if you are guilty of some particular act or crime, then you'll have memory for specific details that somebody who wasn't involved would not have. And that we should be able to find some indication that you recognize key facts or key details associated with that event or crime. You could assess that using skin conductance responding, like we're doing in the lab. You could assess it using central measures like event-related potentials or fMRI as well. And then this last area, admittedly defined as kind of another category, is what I call other cognitive correlates. And these kinds of approaches depend on the fact that lying takes resources and occupies the brain in a different way than telling the truth. Right? It's probably going to demand more attention. There may be conflicts in how we would respond. We should say yes, but we need to lie, so we might say no. It's going to change the attention and memory load, and both event-related brain potentials and fMRI might be used in the service of detecting that the brain is working differently. Different systems, different functions are being called on when people are lying than when they're telling the truth. And there's certain linguistic analysis that's based on this premise, too, that when people are lying, there may be changes in the structure of the sentence that can be detected. Okay? Of course, none of these perfect, but these are the general approaches. So when somebody comes online with a new approach, like fMRI, there are a couple of companies out there now, NoLie MRI and Cephalos, for example, that are trying to push forward some technology to be a better lie detector, The challenge that I have for them is to say, where do they fit into this general scheme? You know, each one of these approaches, no matter how good the physiological measure, are going to have some weaknesses. Innocent people get worried and aroused. Okay? Guilty people sometimes have bad memories. Okay? And people may get, you know, attentional and memory changes in the context of being accused. So all of these could come up with false positives or false negatives. And no measure is going to be immune from it. And, in case I haven't said this enough, none of these detect lying. Right? These are just things that could be roughly associated with lying. Okay. So now let's go back to the standard polygraph. And we can ask the question, you know, what is this polygraph examiner? Okay. Well, we could ask, first of all, what would be the appropriate training for such a person? Well, we're devising a test that should detect lying, so we'd hope the person would have some psychometric skills, the knowledge of test construction and the basic psychometric properties of reliability and validity of instruments. We'd hope they have some clinical interviewing skills, since they're trying to elicit information from people. They ought to have a fairly good knowledge of the physiology of the different autonomic response systems that they're recording from. They'd have to know how to handle those data in terms of physiological scoring and data analysis. And probably, like any kind of administration of a psychological test, they should have some knowledge of the ethics of administering the test and reporting the results, including the limits of the interpretation and the limits of confidentiality. And we can compare that to the training that they receive, which is generally about a 7-week course at one of many certified polygraph training schools that are primarily staffed by professional polygraphers. Now, the standard test that's used again and again in the field is the control question technique. So when we talk about the polygraph, what we're usually referring to is using this field flight case recorder with a particular kind of procedure, the control question technique, that was developed by John Reed in 1947. And it's specifically designed for use in specific incidents investigations where there's been a specific event that's happened that we want to find out if the person did it. So there are about 10 questions in this procedure, and there are questions that are relevant to the crime at hand. They address the matter under investigation. It's the did you do it question. You know, on the 26th of June 2005, did you shoot Mr. Fisbee? And that would be a relevant question if we're investigating the murder of Mr. Fisbee. Okay. And then there are also control questions. These are questions that are developed by the examiner after a pretest interview, and they address generally questionable behavior. Like, have you ever lost your temper with somebody? Have you ever gotten in a fight? Those would not be directly relevant, but they would be control questions here. Okay. And the polygraph examiner stresses that there are two ways to fail the test. You can look like you committed the crime, or you can look like the kind of person who might have committed the crime because you seem to be guilty of all these kinds of questionable acts and suspicious kinds of acts. Now, at least three separate charts are administered. That is, they go through these 10 questions at least three separate times. Okay. And as I just said, the pretest interview stresses there's two ways to fail the test. You can fail the test because you look guilty of the specific crime-relevant items, or you can fail the test because you look like the kind of person who could have done it. Okay. And the pretest interview also stresses the infallibility of the test, and often there will be a rigged demonstration of how well the test works, what they call a stim test. So they'll have the person take a card, the examiner will know perfectly well what card it is, and will show how the polygraph then identifies the person who's lying about what card they took. So the poor person going into this without having heard this talk believes this is probably, coming in, thinks this is a highly accurate test. They believe I'm doomed, I could look like I did it, or I could look like I could have done it. The test is going to find me out. And CQT theory, and I put theory in quotes because this is not theory in the scientific sense, but it's named itself CQT theory. The logic or the rationale or the justification for this procedure is that innocent people should look react more strongly with strong emotion to these control questions because their contents have more relevance to them. And guilty subjects should respond with stronger emotion to the relevant questions. And so what you do in the CQT is to compare the magnitude of response to relevant and control questions. If you have a bigger response to relevant questions, you're deemed guilty. Bigger response to control questions, you're deemed innocent. Okay. Now, looking over that rationale, you can say, well, I could see this rationale. Guilty people should be pretty upset about these questions, but innocent people might still be really worried about those questions. And as you'll see, well, this test works reasonably well with guilty people, but it doesn't work so well with innocent people. Okay. Yes? Turns out, I'll show you a study in a little bit, psychopaths still don't elude the test at high rates. Okay. Yeah, you think that they don't have the anticipatory anxiety, but they'll still have a response to that question. Yes?
So, I'm sorry. So it says if you react stronger to the control question, then you're deemed innocent.
Yes.
But
so,
aren't some of those control questions tell you whether you're guilty of questionable behavior and tell you?
Right. Well, it tells you might be lying about that. But you oftentimes would ask questions that nobody who's really telling the truth could deny entirely. Like, let's say there was a theft, and I say, "Have you ever taken anything that hasn't belonged to you?" Well, I mean, I'm sure you must have like walked off with a pencil one time that you didn't intend to, or you know, you ran out of staples, so you brought some staples home from the office. If you really thought about it, you'd have to say yes, but of course you're hooked up and you'd say no. So there's some doubt about this. So the idea is that you get a whole bunch of behaviors that everybody would have to, in their heart of hearts, say yes to, but it will worry the innocent people more and cause them to be more aroused than the guilty people. I'm not saying that's true. I'm saying that's the logic of the procedure. You need to swap tapes? Okay.
Yep.
Okay, so there aren't two ways to fail the test. There's really only one way to fail the test, and that's to respond more to the relevant questions. But the polygraph examiner stresses that there are two ways to fail the test. Okay. Okay. All right. So let's say that there was some abuse of a little kid, and this is your test. Did you slap Tommy? Did you ever hit anyone? Did you threaten Tommy? Did you ever told a lie to stay out of trouble? Did you ever threatened anyone? Did you punch Tommy? Okay. So you look this over. And switch up the control and the relevant. And as you look at this, of course, there are some relevant and some control questions. Now, I'd hope that the polygraph examiner devises a test a little better than this, because Tommy's name is in all of the relevant questions. And, you know, I wouldn't have to have ever even met Tommy. His name would probably make me pretty nervous, and I'd start responding to all these kinds of questions. Okay, but that would be the basic idea here. Okay. And then hypothetically, then, here's what we would see, and maybe this addresses your question a little bit more specifically, is that let's look right here just at the skin conductance channel. That's this channel right here in the middle. So that this is an innocent person, so a control question is asked right here, and they have a big response to that control question because they're worried they could look like the kind of person who might have done it. They believe they didn't do it, and they think the procedure is accurate, so they shouldn't then have any big response to the relevant question here. So a much bigger response to the control than the relevant. Here we have the hypothetically guilty person. Control question comes up. They're not too worried about it. Relevant question comes up, and there's a big response. Okay? So that's hypothetically what would happen, and you see those differences right there and right there. Okay. Now, there's a semi-objective method of scoring where each relevant question is paired with the nearest control item, and there's a score of -1 to -3 if the response to the relevant is a little somewhat or clearly larger than the control item. So they're not even trying to quantify, resistance in kilo-ohms. They're just quantifying, a little, little more or a lot. And then a score of +1 to +3 is assigned if the response to the relevant item is a little somewhat clearly smaller than the control item. And then you add them up across each response channel and each of the different charts and question pairs. And so if they get a score of -6, they're considered deceptive, > +6, truthful, and in between, inconclusive, which probably means they're going to then have to suffer some further interrogation. But this is only one piece that goes into the whole thing. So this is part of what the polygrapher does, but they render an overall clinical impression. And for those of you who've thought a bit about clinical versus actuarial prediction, you'll know that clinical impressions are fraught with all kinds of problems. And so they make this global impressionistic decision that incorporates the case facts. So they kind of have a bunch of information coming in about circumstantial evidence and past record and criminal history, the behaviors of the examinee, what they see in the person when they're there, the actual chart data that they scored, as well as, everything else, their hunches and impressions, and they come up with a conclusion. Now, the problem with this is that then their outcome is not independent of all the other case facts. So anything the polygrapher says might not tell us what the polygraph is doing as much as what, all of the case facts add up to. So they're not scoring the charts blindly. And I think this is important. And the best study to illustrate this is not in the peer-reviewed literature, but in the 60 Minutes archives. So 60 Minutes did an investigative study. And I've decided, by the way, if 60 Minutes ever comes to ask me about anything, I'm not here. They never make anything they do. They never make anybody look good. And I love watching them, but it's always somebody else that doesn't look good. And so what they did is they hired some polygraph firms to examine four employees who'd been accused of theft of a camera. And there was actually no camera that had been stolen. So you have these four employees that might have stolen a camera that wasn't actually stolen. Okay. But of course the employees didn't know that and the polygraph firms didn't know that. And without the knowledge of the employee, each polygrapher, so these three different firms, was told that a different employee was suspected by the management. So the case facts are leading towards one or another employee, a different one for each firm. So we should expect in this case, if the polygraph is valid, there should be no systematic outcome. Everybody should be indeterminate, or at least the guilty people shouldn't line up with the a priori expectation. And yet in each instance, the suspected employee was deemed guilty. And the probability of that by chance is 1 in 4 times 1 in 4 times 1 in 4, which is pretty low. Right? So clearly, the polygraph outcome is not independent of a lot of extra polygraph information. Okay. Of course, clearly meaning four subjects in a 60-minute study, but you get the point. Okay, so a couple of concerns and assumptions about how this test works. So there are four assumptions that are required in order to get valid results with the polygraph test. With the CQT. The first is that the examiner can formulate relevant questions that guilty people are going to answer deceptively. And that's probably reasonable. There's all kinds of case facts. You ask somebody about them, and if they're guilty, they're going to lie about them. Okay? That's not so hard. They also construct control questions that subjects will answer untruthfully or at least with some doubt as to their veracity. And this is plausible, but it's clearly more difficult than the first kind of question. And then an innocent person should be more disturbed by the control questions than the relevant questions, and I think that's implausible. Okay. And a guilty person should be more disturbed by the relevant questions. I think that's reasonable. Now, as you look at these, the first and the fourth determine how well the procedure works with guilty people. And you can see my armchair assessment is that those are reasonable assumptions. And the second and third determine how well the procedure does with the innocent people. And you can see that there are some problems with those assumptions. And that means going into this, you'd expect the test doesn't work so well with innocent people. Okay. Now, if you look at a summary of literature, and this comes from the chapter by Iacono and Patrick. It's an earlier chapter they've recently updated, and it's also alluded to in a chapter. If you bought the handbook, there's a chapter by Bill Iacono on many of these issues, including some of these data. Looking at the studies that were conducted by professional polygraphers, you can see that these are the percent correct classification for guilty people. This 100 just moved over there. So pretty high there. And percent classification accuracy for innocent people. So the weighted total across studies is 91% of the guilty people look guilty and 94% of the innocent people look innocent. And that looks pretty good. But then you get the social scientists involved. And they find a different pattern of results. And their weighted total is about, again, close to 90% of guilty people look guilty. But only about 57% of innocent people look innocent. So there's a very high false positive rate. 43% of innocent people look guilty across these studies. Now, you could accuse the polygraphers of lying, you could accuse the social scientists of lying, but there's another variable that's hidden behind these, which has to do with the types of studies that are conducted. And there are some studies that are conducted in the laboratory using mock crimes, and there are other studies conducted in the field using case data. And both have their limitations that have to be recognized. So one of the problems with laboratory studies is that seldom are we able to have a case where people are fearing being detected. Now, you could think about setting up a nice deception detection study, bring in your INDV 101 students, come in, you tell them to lie, and what do? You say, well, and if you're successful, I'll give you this Amazon gift certificate. Or if you're successful, you're enrolled in this lottery. If you're successful, here's $20. All of this is an incentive motivation for something positive. And if they screw up, they still get their 4 points and they go home. There's not much fear or arousal going on here. Right? You can't say, and if you fail, you're going to get an F in INDV 101. And you know, you could even maybe, if the ethics board would allow, come up with something that you're not going to do to scare them, but it's really hard to mimic what happens in the real world. You've been dragged in, now you're being interrogated, and if it doesn't go well for you, you're going to be in court and probably in jail. Right? That's just a very different set of circumstances. Okay. So what I'm going to talk about here is two different sets of studies, one of which was much more realistic than the other in terms of this fear motivation. So the first study was by David Raskin and Bob Hare, and they were looking at whether or not psychopathy might be a variable that would influence outcome on this test. They thought maybe, like your question, Jenny, that you know psychopaths might be better at being not detected, better at looking innocent. And it turns out that didn't really matter very much. So this was a prison study. They go in and they find psychopaths and non-psychopaths. And it was set up in a fairly standard way that if you beat the test, you get a reward. I can't remember what it was, you know, like privileges or greater, you know, more money at the canteen or something like that. And their rates looked pretty much like the professional polygraphers, in fact. Now, Chris Patrick and Bill Iacono did a replication of this study, but with a very interesting twist. They set it up so that there was fear motivation. So they also went into the prison. They also find psychopath and non-psychopathic prisoners. But they set it up this way. They said, now there's a bunch of prisoners who've agreed to the study, and you're all going to take this polygraph test. So you'll commit a mock crime, which you know both of these studies did. You go in and sneak into a room and steal some money. And then you'll undergo the polygraph test. And if enough of you who participate beat the polygraph test, then everybody will get the rewards in the study, like more privileges or more money in the canteen. But if not enough people make it, nobody will. And everybody's results are posted here on this board for people to see. Okay. So now...
The IRB was okay with that?
Yeah, the Canadian IRB, in my seems to be a little more reasonable about these things. So now you clearly have fear motivation, right? You don't want to be the guy who screwed it up for all those other guys and have your name up there showing that you failed the polygraph test and because of you, they didn't get what they wanted, right? And under those circumstances, guilty people look guilty, but innocent people often look guilty as well. So the accuracy now across here is, you know, around 60%, close to the 57% that I showed you before of innocent people looking innocent. In other words, a little over 40% of innocent people looking guilty. Okay. Now, no prisoners were actually harmed in that experiment. They gave everybody what they were expecting. Okay. So realism is clearly an important variable in this. And so in some of the studies, if you have a mock crime study without being appropriately real, innocent people will often look innocent. But when you make it real and there's fear motivation, they may look guilty. Okay. Now, the trouble with field studies has to do with how the cases are selected. So if we knew the truth, a polygraph probably wouldn't have been given in the first place. Right? The only reason we give the polygraph is because we're not sure what has happened. So the question for these studies is, how do you establish ground truth? What is really happening? So, you know, judicial verdicts are certainly a candidate, but there are problems with judicial verdicts because the judicial verdict doesn't always map onto the truth. Right? People may plea bargain their case and accept a lower, you know, offense. And there may be false convictions. People may get off because the evidence wasn't strong enough. It wasn't beyond a reasonable doubt. And, of course, the judicial verdict itself could be influenced by the polygraph. So that's probably not a good criterion variable for ground truth. So what's often used are confessions. And when somebody confesses, we assume they're guilty. And when somebody else confesses, we assume that this other person was innocent. So if I was accused but somebody else confessed, we'd assume that I was innocent. So that's the logic, and these are the designs. But these confessions are often gathered only after the subjects failed the test, which leads to a very unfortunate selection bias. And to appreciate that, imagine that you're omniscient and you know that you have some guilty people and you have some innocent people, and they all get subjected to polygraph tests, and of course some people pass and some people fail in both groups. And now, let's see what happens. So, a guilty person who passed the polygraph probably doesn't all of a sudden have a motivation to confess, so there won't be very many confessions here. And if there's no confession in this case, the case can't be selected. Okay? So, they can't be selected for study because there's no confession in that case. Now, if they failed the polygraph, still some people will stand by their story and they'll say they're innocent and they won't confess. Again, they wouldn't be selected for the study. But some people will fail the polygraph and confess, so they'd be selected. Okay? And those people will make it into the study. Okay? Now, amongst the innocent people, people who fail the polygraph probably won't confess. I mean, maybe they would have a false confession, but they're probably not going to confess. And certainly those who pass the polygraph shouldn't have any motivation to confess. So none of these in the study, but sometimes somebody who passes the polygraph will be cleared by another person's confession. So another person then would confess, and thus this person who passed the polygraph would be selected. Okay? So from among all these guilty and innocent people, we're just seeing a small subset of the people using this logic of based on confession. So now, looking at that, what's the feedback that polygraphers receive, and what kind of results would we see in the study? Well, all these cases go away, and all these cases go away. And that leaves us with the stunning finding that 100% of those who confess failed the polygraph, and 100% of those who are exonerated by another confession, passed the polygraph. So there's a near tautological result here that's the result of a selection bias. And this was pointed out very clearly by David Licken and Bill Iacono and others. Okay, so it's bad news, but it's even worse news for screening tests. And the reason for this is that these tests have such high false negative rates. They work very poorly with innocent people. And when you have instances where most people are innocent, you're going to accumulate a lot of classification errors in these situations. So let's imagine then that we have 100 prospective employees, and that the base rate of, you know, evil, nefarious, stealing employees is about 10%. So out of these 100 people, actually 10% should look guilty and 90% should look innocent. And we hire a polygraph firm and they come in and they administer the test. And since 90% of guilty people look guilty, we get 9 of the 10 guilty people. We only one of them comes to work for our company. But amongst all those potentially perfectly good employees, let's say 50% end up looking innocent and 50% end up looking guilty. Now you see that you've mistakenly classified 45% of them as unsuited for employment. Okay. Now, if you're, you know, an employer, this may not worry you. You care about getting, you know, the good people. But on the other hand, it might be concerning if these kinds of tests are used routinely across many different employers. And so the overall accuracy of this procedure, when these base rates deviate wildly from 50%, itself plummets. It's only 54% here. Okay. So this is an idea that Bill Iacono gave me of just bringing the point home. And so I've constructed here the graduate student polygraph policy. We're going to implement it. You know, it's graduate student recruitment time. So starting next year, this is the policy. All right. In response to Homeland Security concerns, all graduate students in psychology now must pass a polygraph test. And in addition to the initial test, existing students must pass a test once every 2 years. They'll no longer be provided with funding. Okay. This will speed up graduation rates, I know. Okay. In case you're wondering, it's hypothetical. Okay. So here's your test. You have some relevant questions and some irrelevant questions. So, have you ever inappropriately cited others' work? We're looking for cases of plagiarism. Have you misrepresented your skills or abilities? That could be problematic. Have you ever misused university resources? Right? We don't want these kinds of people getting into graduate school, right? And then we have some control questions. Have you ever violated a traffic law? Have you ever said something you later regretted? Have you ever lied to a coworker about anything? Okay, so this is your test. And you go through this test, and the polygrapher then tells you, I'm getting some reactions here. I'm wondering if there's something bothering you haven't told me about. I want to help you pass this test, but I can't do it if you aren't 100% honest with me. Is there something you aren't telling me? He's trying to elicit a confession. That's how it works. So what are you going to do? So should I tell him about when I cited a primary source in a research paper when all I really saw was a secondary review? Should I come clean? I really didn't do the multi-level repeated measures hierarchical model of Bayesian inference at the first level all by myself? Should I confess I Xeroxed my two-page 1040 EZ on the university Xerox machine when the April 15th deadline loomed? So you can see how people might end up, you know, confessing under these kinds of circumstances. And of course, they could just look, you know, guilty. And of course, you're probably kind of concerned about a procedure like this. You could say, has there ever been a systematic investigation into the efficacy of this procedure? Given the base rates of nefarious graduate students are very low, shouldn't I worry about false positive outcomes? Given the commitment of graduate school, I might have to take this test several times before graduating. What's the cumulative likelihood of my failing? Has this polygrapher ever taken one of these? Isn't there some alternative to this test? Okay. And so what we'll talk about next is alternatives, but first a question.
I'm confused about something. With the polygraph, you've got relevant and control questions. What does it mean if you score highly on relevant and highly on control, doesn't that kind of keep alive that difference between the two?
Then you would be in that indeterminate category, which means we can't exonerate you, but we can't clearly incriminate you either. But you might be a candidate for further interrogation.
So if some of your if you're high and high, then you might be like somebody who's really anxious, and if you're
yes.
low, you might just be a psychopath. But
although it doesn't seem psychopaths really do much better on this anyway. But yeah, so there'd be kind of a low aroused person, a high aroused person. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Could also mean you're using countermeasures, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Squishing your toes.
Yep. Uh huh. Okay. So the alternative, and those of you in the lab have been introduced to this, is the guilty knowledge technique. And it doesn't assess lying as indexed by emotional arousal. It instead assesses recognition as indexed by a skin conductance orienting response. And it was devised by David Licken, pictured here. And David Licken devised this in the 50s. It was one of his early papers. And he reasoned that it might be a better way to try to detect people who are not telling the truth, but we don't have to worry about all these false positives. It's sometimes called the concealed information test. In fact, the demonstration that I did here was a variant of the of this test, right? Was the number one, was the number two, was the number three. That, sure, you were lying to the number four, but it worked because we depended upon there being a recognition response, an orienting response to the relevant alternative. And of course, this can use any number of dependent measures. When David Licken proposed it, skin conductance was clearly the measure in vogue, and that's what he used in the paper that those of you in the lab are modeling the study on. Okay. So this doesn't assess lying as indexed by fear of being detected, but probes for guilt by indexed by recognition. So you get a series of multiple choice questions, each of which has several alternatives, and only one is true about the crime in question. So the chances of an innocent person looking guilty on this get pretty small. So what's the chance of you having a maximum response to the relevant alternative out of 5 on 10 questions? Well, it's 1 in 5 times 1 in 5 times 1 in 5 times 1 in 5. So it's 1 over 5 to the 10th, which is, for all intents and purposes, infinitesimally small. Okay. So it protects against false positive responses. So let's say that there was a robbery. So we might have questions about what was taken. We might have questions about the getaway vehicle. We might have questions about some phone numbers that the phone records thought were involved. We might have questions about the time of day and so on. It's easy to imagine that you might just by chance have a large response to some answer that happens to be associated with the crime. Right? If a particular kind of jewelry was stolen, let's say a ring, and you just happened to get a ring recently and it was on your mind, maybe you'd have a big response to ring. But it would be unlikely that you'd have the maximum response also to the type of getaway car and to the phone numbers involved and the time of day and so on. So although you could have the maximum response by chance to one of those questions, you shouldn't have the maximum response to a lot of those questions. And so that's how it protects against innocent individuals looking guilty. So you use this when the information about the crime or event is available that a real culprit would know, but it's not so widely available that everybody would know it. And a series of questions are constructed, only one of which has the correct detail. So, for example, regarding the abduction location, we'll go back to Tommy again. Okay, some poor thing happened to Tommy. Was it a toy store? A shopping mall? And of course, you would say, as the suspect, no to each of these. Was it a city park? Was it at a friend's house, at school, at a restaurant? And these would be given one after another with long breaks in between because the skin conductance response system is slow. And the first alternative is never the relevant alternative because people will often have the maximal response to the first item in a series. So it would be one of these others. Of course, the subject doesn't know that. And then there would be other questions about like the time the person was taken, what clothing the abductee was wearing, and so on. Okay. Subject's instructed to answer no to each item so that if the person's guilty, they'd be lying then to that critical item. And the critical item is never positioned at the beginning. And a consistent peak of physiological response on the critical item suggests guilt. Now, one should not be there, because just one wouldn't. But consistently on the critical item, it would suggest guilt. Now, looking at lab studies using the guilty knowledge test and looking across studies, now we can see, here's study medians presented, that about 90% of the time, again, guilty people look guilty. That figure is very comparable to the CQT. But more importantly, most of the time, innocent people look innocent. So it does a much better job of protecting innocent people. Now, it's obviously superior to the control question technique, especially in protecting the innocent. But there's resistance about using it in the polygraph community. One of them, you know, there's some concerns that are founded and probably some concerns that are not founded. One of the concerns is about applicability in high-profile cases. So when the case facts are widely known, it might be hard to devise a test that, you know, an innocent person wouldn't recognize the case facts. So if you remember back, if you can, to the O.J. Simpson trial, you know, all of the artifacts like the Bruno Mali shoe, you know, if you were paying attention to any media at the time and you were accused of killing Nicole Brown Simpson, when they said, what kind of shoe did the killer wear, and up comes Bruno Mali, you'd have a huge response to it because it was widely known that that matched the crime. So you'd have to come up with things that weren't widely known. But David Licken addressed this in his book, A Tremor in the Blood. And he devised a guilty knowledge test for O.J. Simpson. Now, not based on actual case facts, but things that he thought might be available that the public wouldn't know anything about. Like, what was Nicole Brown Simpson wearing at the time that she died? And then you have plausible alternatives. Was it a, you know, pajamas? Was it a sweatsuit? Was it jeans and a top? Was it a swimsuit? And so on. Things that the public might not know, but the criminal presumably would know about. Now, the other concern, and I think reason why it might not be adopted, is that the control question technique still has a lot of utility for eliciting confessions. Right? That the outcome can make it such that, you know, even if it's indeterminate, a confession may ensue. In fact, when I gave a variant of this presentation to a public lecture here on campus, at the beginning of the talk, there was a police officer in the back of the room eating his lunch. It was a lunchtime talk. And I went up to talk to him because I wanted to know what his take was before I started going on about all this stuff. And I just, you know, said hi and said, do you have experience with the polygraph? He says, yeah. He says, the test is totally inaccurate, but it's really useful. And he essentially made my point for me that it doesn't have to be accurate for it to be useful. It elicits confessions. And he went on to tell, you know, quite a few tales of people in the police screening, because, you know, police officers use it routinely. They just start fessing up about all kinds of things, that, you know, affairs and embezzlement and all kinds of things that come out because they don't want it to, you know, make them, I don't know, they didn't want it to come out on the test. Okay. So, you know, it's still used. Now, I should say that although the guilty knowledge test is not used in forensic applications in this country very often, it is used much more widely in Israel and Japan. So you'd have to think about training the criminal investigators to look for crime facts and devise, you know, get information that would allow you to devise a guilty knowledge test. Okay.
Why don't they use it?
Well, I think there's this resistance to it because the polygraph community controls, you know, the tests. They elicit confessions, and they make the case that it's not widely applicable. But I think to be widely applicable, even when a case is you know, high profile case, just needs to be some more creative investigation that goes on. It might also change the way in which facts about crimes are released to the media as well. Now, keep in mind that a guilty verdict on a guilty knowledge test doesn't mean that somebody was the criminal. It just means that they know information. They could have been the mastermind. They could have been the witness. They could have been the victim. I mean, you know, any number of things could happen. It's just that they have information about the crime. And then, as I say, they got some splaining to do when that comes. Mm-hmm.
Do you think if you can apply, ask questions where... there might not be a right or wrong answer, and maybe you can, like for the O.J. Simpson thing, like with the clothing, like, well, it's his wife, you know, so you might know what she's wearing when she died, mm-hmm. He was really traumatic for him, and he always remembers him. But if they asked him a question, like, which body part was grabbed right before she was killed, and they said the arm, the leg, mm-hmm. the neck, mm-hmm. And then he showed big physiological response for his arm. I mean, would that show in other people when you say, you know, would other people show a huge response for those because they don't, you know, they don't really care, and then he might because.
I see. So you're saying if you don't know the answer and you're using the skin conductance response as a way of trying to identify what actually happened?
Well, I guess, but just to see if, yeah, I guess kind of, but even just to see if there's a huge response for something that other people wouldn't really test highly for.
Mm-hmm.
Like, which, if somebody asked me that, and like, I don't know if I would respond highly to the arm more than the leg or whatever, but...
Well, for the guilty knowledge test to work, you have to know what actually happened in order to match it up. So, if you're proposing something else where you use it as an investigative tool to try to figure out what happened, you'd have to run lots and lots of people and see what the kind of baseline level of response to these items would be. And then, you'd almost have to know who the criminal was at that point and then get the details. It'd be a very different use, I think, of the test than the GKT. So for the GKT, you'd have, you know, if nobody witnessed the crime, you couldn't ask a question like you suggest of what body part was grabbed right before the murder, because you'd have to have somebody who witnessed it, and if you had somebody witnessed it, I guess you know who did it. So you'd have to find circumstantial evidence. Okay. And, you know, you'd have to be clever, but you'd also have to have things that you think the actual perpetrator would know. So maybe, you know, you noticed that there was a brick walkway leading up to the murder scene, but maybe the killer just didn't notice that. And maybe, you know, the investigator comes in and sees, you know, Nicole Brown Simpson in a paisley wrap, but the killer doesn't have an eye for fashion and just doesn't really notice, you know, what she's wearing. So you'd have to think about things that would really be obvious and that the killer should remember, or the suspect should remember. Okay. Now, one of the questions that comes up with both the CQT and the GKT is, could you implement countermeasures? These are, you know, measures designed to foil the test, so that you as a suspect, could you employ measures to foil the test? And there have been a few studies about this, so I'll just give you a sample of some of them. First of all, you know, one of the things would be, what about taking drugs at the time of the test? Maybe if I take anti-anxiety medications of some sort, or things that should otherwise calm me down, would we see that there would be a lower rate of detection? And a couple of studies by Bill Iacono found that there were really no effects relative to placebo for a variety of different anti-anxiety types of medications or stimulants as well. The overall hit rate for guilty people was still over 90%. So taking a downer or an upper at the time of the test probably isn't going to change the outcome dramatically based on this study. Now, there was also a study looking at street drugs and alcohol use by Bradley and Ainsworth in 84. And in this study, they actually had people be mildly intoxicated at the time of the crime. So the Human Subject Committee approved to get people mildly intoxicated, and then they commit a mock crime. So they sit around and they have either their, you know, orange juice with vodka or their orange juice.
Is it Canada
too? No, this is in the States. We just wasn't here at the University of Arizona. Then they had them do the mock crime. And it did decrease detectability during the polygraph. So there may be something about, you know, encoding here that's more important than actually at the retrieval stage. And, you know, they didn't determine, you know, they didn't do street drugs in this study, for example. Okay. All right. Now, what about physical countermeasures? These have been probably studied the most. You can find out all about this if you just go out to the web at looking for how to beat the polygraph. Charles Hantz has done a series of studies on this, and he found that 78% of highly motivated subjects could be trained to beat the control question technique by biting their tongues or pressing their toes to the floor during control questions. That took some training. They had to learn about the test. They had to be able to appropriately identify control questions and relevant questions. But it's not the kind of training that motivated suspects couldn't obtain, right? And it could easily be obtained. And this was in the pre-internet day. Now you can easily obtain it just by going out and Googling it. Also, the polygraphers didn't detect these subtle measures. But in the spirit of spy versus counter-spy, Hantz put in counter-counter measures. They used EMG recordings to detect when people were making these muscle tensions. And they detected 80% of those using countermeasures, using these counter-counter measures. But counter-counter measures are not routinely used in field polygraphy. Okay. This last point is a little detailed. If you go back and you look at the Licken article is assigned, you'll see that he didn't always assume that the relevant response would have the maximal response. He just thought it would deviate from chance expectation. So he devised what he called the rectangularity score. So that for an innocent person, any alternative has an equal chance of being the maximum, second largest, third largest, fourth largest, or smallest response. So that across all the items, you should see a distribution that's relatively rectangular. And that any deviation from that rectangular distribution would indicate guilt. So if I were employing countermeasures in a guilty knowledge test, I might try to respond maximally to some other items other than the relevant alternative. But if I did that, the relevant alternative would systematically look smaller across all these items, and thus the distribution would no longer be rectangular. It would favor a preponderance of small responses for the relevant alternative. And so even then a person might look guilty. So that's another way to protect against it. You don't have to have countermeasures by measuring EMG, but just use a technique where it would be really hard to fool it if you were tensing your toes or biting your tongue or doing any of those things. Okay. So, interim synopsis comes about 5 minutes before the end of class, but the interim synopsis here is, you know, people lie, people are going to lie. I won't lie to you when I tell you that. But there is no unequivocal lie response. There's no way to uniquely identify psychologically, behaviorally, or physiologically that somebody is lying. So we try to look at correlates of that. Traditional polygraphy, which focuses on one correlate, emotional reactions and arousal, suffers from an unacceptably high false positive rate. So after today, I would hope that none of you, if innocent, would want to take a polygraph test to prove your innocence. So the best advice you can take from this lecture is never take a polygraph test unless you're guilty. Because then there's at least a 10% chance you'll get off. Right? Okay. But if you're innocent, those rates are not very good. Okay. I don't think that polygraphers are necessarily mean-spirited, evil, conniving people. I think that they're trained to believe their test is good, and they get feedback that tells them their test is good. So they find people who fail the test, who confess. The research database that they get has a selection artifact to it. And their scoring of the charts is not entirely blind, and so they see the results that a priori they might expect. These are natural kind of clinical judgment errors that we're all prone to, and it's just in the case of the polygraphers, they're prone to make them in an area where it really hurts some people. Okay. So if polygraphers would come and take kind of a standard clinical assessment class in a clinical psychology program, maybe we could change the field. Now, assessing recognition might prove more accurate, but potentially less widely applicable. It's going to take a lot more work to do this. Okay? And polygraphs still are useful for eliciting admissions and confessions, and that's one of the reasons they continue to persist today. What I'm going to do here is just tell you briefly about two findings using a different measure with ERPs. I talked about this the first lecture, so a little bit of it is quite... actually, it's not even in your handout, is it? So let's not do that. Let me just give you... I'll give you a little bit of a sense of the debate in this literature. Okay. So David Licken, in his 1981 version of A Tremor of the Blood, talks about how difficult it has been to change scientific and public opinion. And he says, if I announce to my scientific colleagues that I've invented a new test that can identify schizophrenia with 90 or 95% accuracy, my colleagues will be interested but skeptical. I'd be expected to support my assertion with experimental evidence, and that evidence would be very critically examined. And even if my proofs withstood such scrutiny, many would reserve judgment until an independent investigator had confirmed my findings. All this skepticism about a claim that I can distinguish crazy people from normal ones. The tools of the psychologist are not precision instruments. That's one of my all-time favorite quotes, I have to say. Really high accuracy is seldom achieved. Skepticism is appropriate. Nevertheless, when the polygrapher announces that his psychological test can separate liars from the truthful with a validity of 90, 95, or even 99%, the typical reaction is a kind of marveling acceptance. The critic who questions these claims is greeted with surprise and skepticism. Nearly every American has heard of the lie detector. Without really knowing what is involved, many assume it's nearly infallible. So deeply ingrained is this mystique that gradually over the last 50 years, the burden of proof has somehow shifted to the critic. And then one of the critics, or one of the other side, says, unfortunately, the minute a small handful of psychologists, one or two pseudo-knowledgeable and one or two completely ignorant of what they're even trying to do, got into the picture, two expressions, false positive and false negative, came to light. It appears that some people turn out to be weird ducks. Sadly, when that type of inquirer doesn't understand something, he's usually prone to attach some strange names to it under the guise of professionalism or scientific exploration on both sides of the same coin. By confusing other people more so than himself, he feels he can still call himself an expert. Those two phrases appeared in a tumor in the brain, which is a tremor in the blood. He's referring to David Licken's book. Before then, they'd never existed in polygraph language. In all sincerity, however, fall ball psychologists are few and far between. So David Licken presents this quote, and he says, you know, you just imagine this guy at the end tries to, you know, he realizes he's getting kind of hard, so he has to say, oh, in all sincerity, however, they're few and far between. So there's really, you know, quite a rift in the field and a sense of animosity between them. So if you're interested in this kind of topic, this is a great book. This is the revision of David Licken's A Tremor in the Blood. It's really a great read. He's quite a great storyteller, and he talks about the history of it. He has you as a reader take a polygraph test. I mean, you know, he's interrogating you there right from the pages of the book. It goes pretty well. A slightly drier but very important read is that the National Research Council commissioned committee to review the scientific evidence on the polygraph. This committee was comprised entirely of people who had not been doing work in lie detection, but they're a veritable who's who of psychophysiologists and researchers in emotion, and you have John Cacioppo chairing that committee, for example. This book, which is available entirely online if you want to read it, really deals a death blow to the validity of polygraph testing, and it has continued to be used in curtailing the uses of the polygraph test, at least in the civilian sphere. I think within the government sphere, the military sphere, and contractors for the government, they're kind of doing their own thing, from what I can tell. But at least it's had a very big impact on the private sphere. So those are a couple of really good sources and a lot of the things that I've talked about here. So I think that's probably good for today. And we'll next time pick up on track with cardiovascular psychophysiology.